Well, good evening, and on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to this part of Poets' Corner here in Westminster Abbey. I'm delighted to welcome you to the third of our series of four lectures entitled Excellent Women. The lectures each take an Anglican woman novelist as their subject. This is all a precursor to the publication of a book next year, about which I'll just say a word at the end of the lecture. But tonight our subject is Barbara Pym, and no one better to speak to us of Barbara Pym than Jane Williams. Dr. Jane Williams is Assistant Dean and Lecturer in Systematic Theology at St. Mellitus College and Visiting Lecturer in Theology at King's College London, having previously taught at Trinity College Bristol. She's authored several books on theology and its practice, is an experienced editor, and is regularly invited to teach and to speak all over the world. And I know that she's a very keen proponent promotes theological education in the very best sense of theological education, not only in this country, but around the Anglican Communion. She tells me she has a passion for Barbara Pym, so I'm very much looking forward to hearing what she has to say and to inspiring me to read properly some of Barbara Pym's novels. Jane, over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's a delight to be here in this lovely setting and to talk about Barbara Pym. My temptation is really just to stand here and read you chunks of Barbara Pym, and I will do a little bit of that because she is irresistible. Am I audible? Yes? Good? Excellent. If I get less audible, which I tend to when I get excited, and I do get excited when I'm talking about Pym, will you either go to sleep or wave at me, whichever is more helpful for you? Can I just check how many of you have read at least some Barbara Pym? Excellent. Okay, that's very helpful. So you did, that's good to know, so I won't do too much explaining about the context of her novels. I've given you a very, very slight handout. It's basically a reading list, in case there are novels on there that you haven't yet come across. I recommend the Barbara Pym Society website. They're constantly updating things. They have some wonderful, wonderful resources there. And Pym's own papers are in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, if anybody wants to go and check. She was a great writer, Barbara Pym. She wrote almost from birth and came from that generation where writing includes letters, diaries, and we have quite a lot of those. Her style is unmistakable. You can pick a Pym up, and even with no headings on it, you would know it was her. And she writes in the same kind of style in her letters and her diaries. She's a very, very distinctive voice. She has a way of surveying the people she's writing about and herself, indeed, when she's writing her diaries, with a kind of gentle and dispassionate humour. She's never unkind, but she's never sentimental. So, for example, when writing about herself and a real student crush she had when she was in Oxford, she records bumping into the subject of the crush and saying that her legs and her knees were trembling and weak with the sheer excitement of meeting him. But that didn't stop her noticing that the young man talks curiously but very waffly, is very affected and can't help snurging. Not quite sure what snurging is, but somehow I get the picture, don't you? So that ability to see both her own passion and with that slight dispassionate understanding of the nature of the young man that she was in love with. That comes from one of her diaries, something collected in The Very Private Eye, again, which I put on your handout, I think. Her first published novel didn't actually appear until 1950, and that was Some Tame Gazelle. But it was by no means the first thing that she'd written. She'd been getting rejections from publishers from as early as 1936. Any of you who've tried writing will be pleased to know that rejections are just part of the writing trade. But the publication of Some Tame Gazelle in 1950 was the beginning of a steadily successful writing career, with novels appearing with great regularity between 1950 and 1961. And then, in what was to her at least a wholly unexpected turn of events, Pym's next novel was rejected by her long-term publisher, Jonathan Cape. And she was not published again until 1977. So that's between 1961 and 1977, she was not published. Her publishers felt that she was not addressing a world that people wanted to read about anymore. And then in 1977, something extraordinary happened. The TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, ran a New Year edition in which they asked various notable people to select and nominate their favourite, most underrated novelist. And two people nominated Barbara Pym, Lord David Cecil and the poet Philip Larkin, independently, without consulting each other, named Pym as one of the most underrated novelists of the century. And suddenly, funnily enough, publishers wanted to publish her again. You may not be surprised to hear she did not go back to Jonathan Cape. And since 1977, she has been in print continuously in lots and lots of different formats. I got a lot of her on Kindle, for example. She has a worldwide fan base. A lot of the Barbara Pym Society publications come from America. And she has remained fashionable ever since. And as well as the novels that she wrote between 1977 and her death in 1980, her literary executor found unpublished novels, some of which have appeared in publication since. And we've got a biography and some of her diaries. She has a great following all round the world. And it's something to do with this particular gentle, humorous understanding of the world that I hope I'm going to give you a little flavour of, although it looks as though most of you already know it. Perhaps inevitably, Pym is compared with Jane Austen. As far as I can see, pretty well anybody who doesn't write bodice rippers is compared with Jane Austen if they're a female novelist. There is some truth in the comparison with Austen. Pym writes about a limited social sphere, with very few hints of an outside world, very few hints of world events, and her narrative perspective is generally feminine. We hear the thoughts of Pym's female characters far more often than of her male ones. And when we do listen in to men thinking, what we often hear is without that kind of honest self-knowledge that characterises Pym's women. So, for example, towards the end of No Fond Return of Love, we see Aylwin Forbes, who through most of the book has been passionately in love with Dulcie's niece, suddenly realising that actually he'd rather be in love with Dulcie, and he's heading in a taxi to tell her this, and wondering quite how she might receive it. As for his apparent change of heart, he'd suddenly remembered the end of Mansfield Park, and how Edmund fell out of love with Mary Crawford and came to care for Fanny. Dulcie must surely know the novel well and would understand how such things can happen. What a surprise it would be, not least to his family and to Dulcie himself, who had so often urged him to make a suitable marriage, if when he was free this very marriage should come about. So he's telling himself a story that will make it fine for him suddenly to fall out of love with a much younger woman and in love with a suitable woman. And Dulcie's reaction to that, she sees him charging up the driveway with a large bunch of flowers and wonders to herself why he's bringing her flowers when she's a notable gardener. So that slight contrast of the way in which we hear the characters reflecting. In her novels, Pym's two most usual worlds are an Anglican parish, a group of parishioners, or an assortment of anthropologists. She worked on the Journal of International African Anthropology for a number of years in order to make a living alongside her writing. And sometimes in some books you get both. They interchange. And these two, the parish and the anthropological world, give her two kind of, you might say, tribal contexts. where her characters share a kind of a strange jargon and a set of practices that are not readily understandable to others. And she's able to observe them and help us see them as almost as an anthropologist would, with great humour. She herself came from a church-going family. Her mother was the assistant organist in the local church, and her passion for entertaining curates is gloriously reconstructed in the Miss Harriet and Belinda Bede's attentions in Some Tame Gazelle. Again, I can't quite resist this, which is told from Belinda's point of view. Neither she nor Harriet had ever married, but Harriet was making her usual fuss over the new curate and was obviously prepared to be quite as silly over him as she had been over his predecessors. She was especially given to cherishing young clergymen, and her frequent excursions to the curate's lodgings had often given rise to talk, but people did like a bit of gossip, especially about a respectable spinster and church worker like Miss Harriet Bede. So the necessity of providing chicken in white sauce for generations of curates plays a large part in Some Tame Gazelle, which was one of her first books. Her own preference was for Anglo-Catholic worship. She was not herself what you might call a conventionally pious person. If you read her diaries, it's clear that she had all kinds of storms of passion in her life. But she did continue the practice of her faith throughout her life, even serving on the PCC of her local church in Finstock in Oxfordshire when she retired. And I don't think you can get more dedicated than serving on a PCC, can you? She recognised the foibles and the fallibility of the Church of England, but treated it with the same kind of affection that she did with the characters in her novels. She reports again as a student on a university sermon in 1932, quote, "somewhat dull, I thought, and full of blah and waffle. But on the other hand, at times of emotional turmoil, for example, in 1943, in the middle of a very unhappy love affair, she records that she went to sit in a church to gain a little bit of solace. One of the things I love about Pym is that it's very much a lay person's view of the church. There's a lot of having to sit and listen to the vicar, and you hear a lot of the thoughts of lay people as they sit and listen to the vicar. And there's a kind of interested detachment and lack of fervour that clergy who don't much talk to their congregations might be a bit surprised by. And, of course, she was writing well before the ordination of women, so this is still very much women parishioners sitting and reflecting on the ministry of men, usually quite indulgently and quite patronisingly, if one is honest. Some of Pym's vicars show very few signs of true fervour and vocation themselves. Again, from Some Tame Gazelle, the wonderful Archdeacon Hockleave, who liked to preach immensely ornate sermons in which he could show off how many quotations he knew, but didn't really like people very much. I'm sure no such clergy exists anymore. This is Mr. Latimer, a young clergyman from Crampton Hodnet, which is one of the books of Pym's that was published posthumously. "Yes, this was the Church of England, his flock," thought Mr. Latimer. "A collection of old women, widows and spinsters, and one young man not quite right in the head. These were the people among whom he was destined to spend his life. He hunched his shoulders in his surplice and shivered. The church with its dampness and sickly smell of lilies felt cold and tomb-like. He had the feeling, as he mumbled through the service, that he and his congregation were already dead." And of course, it's interesting, isn't it, that we're hearing this from inside Mr. Latimer's head. This is what he's genuinely feeling. But we're also hearing Pym hearing him. This is a young man whose feelings about his congregation are less than admirable. He's mumbling his way through the service. Why should even spinsters, widows, and a young man not quite right in the head put up with somebody with so little fervour about their vocation? It's not something that Pym explores, why anybody gets ordained, or indeed why people go to church, really, any more than she talked about her own faith. She was interviewed on Desert Island Discs by Roy Plumley, and that is still available. If you go on the Desert Island Discs website and put in Barbara Pym, you can still hear her. And he does ask her about her faith, which she admits was important to her, but then doesn't unpack that any further. But in her books, the church setting is more than just a convenience. It's not just the country house that Agatha Christie uses for murder mysteries so as to be able to keep people corralled in a nice small space. I think as you read her, what becomes more and more clear is that for her the church setting is a way of gently, uninsistently offering some values about how to live a good life in the reality of the world as it is. Unlike Jane Austen, Pym's world had wider horizons. She studied English at Oxford. She served in the Wrens during the war. She travelled quite widely. She had a huge number of friends, many of them lifelong, others acquired through her literary career, for example, Philip Larkin. There's some lovely photographs of her with Philip Larkin. She had a number of unhappy love affairs, including, as I say, at least one with a married man. And she observed herself through all of these permutations of emotion. She observed her own grief and wrote about it in her diary, describing it as though it was happening to a fictional character rather than herself. So this again is a quote. And what exactly, may posterity ask, was all the struggle about? Why this need for patience and courage? And the bewildered English spinster, now rather gaunt and toothy, but with a mild, sweet expression, may hardly know herself. She's talking about something really painful and looking at it as though she's a novelist looking at herself. She remained single all her life and towards the end of her life shared a home with her sister Hilary after the latter's divorce. And in her novels, people do fall in and out of love, happily and unhappily, and she does depict some successful marriages, for example, Mark and Sophia Ainger in An Unsuitable Attachment, or Jane and Nicholas in Jane and Prudence. Funnily enough, both of those are clerical marriages. But her female characters are not all desperate for love and marriage. Belinda Bede in Some Tame Gazelle is well aware that she and her sister Harriet have a much nicer and simpler life without the hazards of love and marriage. And both are offered opportunities to get married in the course of the novel and reject them because they're happier as they are. And this low-key setting, then, of Pym's books, she could have chosen to write a book set in the war. She did write the beginnings of a spy story set in the war, but the war is very much in a muted background. She could have written about real desperate love affairs, but she chooses this much more low-key way of writing about her world, which shows a depth of self-knowledge about what she was good at. This voice that she'd developed that was very much her own voice. And as I say, it enables her to offer very gently the vision of a good life. So what I'd love to concentrate on for the rest of our time together is just some of what I think are her Anglican values that come through her novels as you read them. For example, the place of the parish in her novels is very interesting. As with any parish, what you see in her novels when she's talking about parish occasions is a collection of very strange people who have nothing else in common except some kind of attachment to the church. There are bazaars, there are trips to Rome with a collection of very strange people who don't have any other kinds of friendship and yet know that they somehow belong together. The quote that heads up this series, Excellent Women, comes from Pym, of course. It's and one of her excellent women, Mildred, is able to find a home in a parish when her parents die that is very much like the home she had when she lived with them and served in a different kind of parish. There's some very colourful, indeed ex-con characters who are accepted within a parish in one of her books. So she is recommending gently or showing us how it is possible to have a group of people who don't have to be alike and yet can accept and trust each other without intrusion. In a parish church, as Pym depicts, you might meet anyone and be required to enter into conversation with them, share tea, obviously, endless cups of tea figure largely in Pym's world, and begin to build the kind of tenuous connections that lead to a relationship that is not worthless, even if it doesn't seem deep at the time. She depicts these wonderfully undemanding Anglican relationships that are nonetheless capable of bearing considerable weight as people change their life circumstances in various ways. So there don't have to be ties of work and class and leisure activity in order to build this kind of community. And that means that the assortment of people that you get in a parish church can be richer, stranger, and more unlikely than would be found in any more natural setting. And that makes for very good novels. But Pym also seems to suggest it makes for more hopeful people. There is an ability to know that a human community will accept you and give you a place. She shows us that a church setting can help you to be part of a story that's bigger than your own, so that your own small story gets set into a much bigger one that has more resonance, more significance than a personal story alone. One of her late novels, published after she was rediscovered, Quartet in Autumn, is one of her most somber novels, and it's the quartet are four people who used to work together in an office and retire at roughly the same kind of time, and who handle retirement with varying degrees of success. It's a very gentle and significant exploration of the life changes that come with retirement. One of the least attractive of the four is the church-going one, a man called Edwin. But what we see is that Edwin has a structure to his life that isn't dependent on his job. So he still has the regular round of services. He still has a church calendar, even when he no longer has a full diary that takes him to work 9 to 5. So this is Edwin musing on his life post-retirement. Palm Sunday, ushering in the services of Holy Week. Low Sunday always seemed a bit of an anticlimax after all that had gone before. But it wasn't long before Ascension Day, and then Whit Sunday or Pentecost. After that you had Corpus Christi, and then Trinity Sunday, followed by all those long, hot summer Sundays. That was how it had always been and how it would go on, in spite of trendy clergy trying to introduce so-called up-to-date forms of worship, rock and roll and guitars, and discussions about the third world instead of Evensong. So you can see what kind of a churchgoer Edwin is. But can you see what I'm saying about the shape of his life? He has a structure that is reliable and that connects him to something bigger than himself. Pym's own diaries are often headed with both calendar and lectionary dates. So she shared with Edwin a world in which context and shape don't have to be invented by each individual, in which there is a rhythm and a pattern that is shared. She has no illusions about this world, writing at one point in her diaries, "But are Christians always and necessarily nice people? Who could like the wise virgins in the Bible, for example? Is that one of the trials of it all, that one must be prepared to be disliked?" And again, that's an interesting kind of challenge. As I say, Edwin is certainly not a sympathetic or attractive character. And his church going, she depicts quite clearly, as a kind of niche interest that fits his rather fussy persona and gives him a kind of self-importance that he likes. But Pym depicts it as offering him this kind of stability that the others who shared his office job and retired at the same time as him have to attempt to manufacture for themselves. And one of the characters that we see in Quartet in Autumn does not manage that change at all. One of his colleagues is called Marcia, and she tragically fails to achieve any kind of life-sustaining rhythm after retirement because she had no other company that she belonged to. She had no other structures to give shape to her life. And in the end, she actually starves herself to death. Again, without saying you need to be a Christian to give structure to your life, she's depicting the choices that we make and the importance of belonging to something bigger than yourself. So the parish, a place of acceptance, a faith that gives you the ability to be part of something bigger than yourself, a structure to a life that you don't have to invent. She thinks that everyday life is really important. And again, I think this is one of the things, one of the reasons why she chose to write as she did, the small, the daily, the slightly ridiculous, rather than going for big themes. She sees the daily common life of ordinary people as the stuff of reality in which God is interested. In Some Tame Gazelle, for example, there's a lovely story of a decayed gentlewoman who is reduced to having to do fine sewing for some of the women in the parish. And Belinda and Harriet are always wanting to be really careful that they treat her with respect, despite the fact that she's doing some work for them. And there's a terrible occasion on which they've forgotten, they've given all the meat to the curate. And so they decide they'll make a cauliflower cheese for this lady. And unfortunately, it turns out there was a slug in the cauliflower cheese. And the sort of pained gentility of the woman who sort of assumes that they didn't care and they didn't mind that she had a slug, and they instantly have to make sure that she has ham and eggs for tea to make up for it. But that sense that it matters and that the little ways in which you offer a meal or a cup of tea say something about the way in which you value people. The small matters. And it's something that she returns to over and over and over again as people offer cups of tea, offer a low-key friendship, eat cake, eat meals together, cover a chicken in white sauce for the benefit of the curate. None of them huge themes, all of them about the sustaining of daily life, the practice of living well in ordinary circumstances. And it's one of the things that some people hate about her novels. Nothing really happens. But then that's life, isn't it, for most of us? Nothing really happens. And yet that doesn't make it insignificant. She's wanting to say something about the practice of living. She's very good at imperfection. That little remark about whether Christians have to be nice people comes through all the way through in her novels. There are no perfect people in a Barbara Pym novel. There aren't any heroes or heroines. There are people whose thoughts you hear, so you stick with them more than with others. But on the whole, what you see is very, very imperfect people. In A Glass of Blessings, Pym describes a relationship that fits none of the conventional stereotypes, and yet that she depicts as a good relationship, a life-giving relationship. It's a novel, a theme that she returns to more than once, in which a slightly spoilt older woman who basically has everything that she wants, including a happy marriage, decides that life is a bit dull and sort of falls in love with a younger man, Piers. There's something a bit dashing about him, a bit unobtainable. She is, as I say, a little bit bored. Her own marriage seems too conventional and dependable. But as the novel progresses, you realise that she's been treating this young man not as a real person, but as a fantasy, something that is an adjunct to her own life. She hasn't really paid attention to him in himself. And when she discovers that Piers is actually gay, she's humbled and enabled to see that her idea of relationships was solipsistic. She had simply seen him as an extension of her own need. Piers and his lover Keith seem a very unlikely couple at first glance, and yet this sardonic and restless Piers that we've met when he's interacting with Wilmot is clearly at home with Keith in a way that he has not been in the rest of the novel. This is Piers talking about relationships. This having things in common, said Piers impatiently. How overrated it is. Long, dreary intellectual conversations, capping each other's obscure quotations. It's so exhausting. It's much more agreeable to come home to some different remarks from the ones one's been hearing all the day. So Keith is taking care of Piers. He's made him a comfortable home. He feeds him well. They talk about completely different things. They are completely at home and at ease with each other. A very unlikely relationship that makes Wilmot realise she hasn't been paying attention to the real stuff of relationships. She has been seeing Piers, and indeed her own husband, as adjuncts to her own feelings rather than as people in their own right. Wilmot's obsession with Piers then is shown up as an essentially self-serving thing with little true knowledge of its object. It's Keith who makes Piers happy, caring for him, making him a home. Pym does this several times, really unostentatious depictions of the relationships between characters, like Piers and Keith, which is all of a piece with her interest in truthful and unsentimental interactions between human beings. She is, in a sense, saying that in all their strangeness and their unlikeliness, Piers and Keith are an ideal relationship, just as Jane and Nicholas are in her novel Jane and Prudence, not because they're perfect, quite the contrary, but precisely because they're happy not to be perfect. They see the other person as a real person and like them. They like spending time with them. They are willing to make a give and take, to adjust to living happily with somebody else. As you can imagine, Pym has been very much appreciated by gay writers because she appears to judge relationships not by the boxes that they tick, but by the way in which they enable truthfulness. Pym was in her day quite unusual in writing so gently and caringly about these relationships. We see a really interesting contrast that shows us Pym looking at what happens with those who cannot accept imperfect relationships, cannot accept the dailiness of ordinary relationships. Again, in a rather somber book called The Sweet Dove Died, she returns to this theme of an older woman who falls for a younger gay man. And the woman at the centre of this is somebody called Leonora, who is completely unwilling to admit any need or any imperfection. And we see, in a really quite chilling way, how this cuts her off from any hope of real happiness, because she will not put up with anything that is not perfect. There's a really telling little moment where we're told that Leonora has replaced the photographs of her parents in her bedroom with photographs of her grandparents, because her grandparents looked more distinguished. It's a lovely little detail, because we're told that Leonora has long ago decided she won't have any more lovers. So she's not expecting anybody else in that bedroom. Nobody else is seeing her distinguished grandparents as opposed to her undistinguished parents. This is entirely about her creating a fantasy of perfection in which she can live. What we find with Leonora is that by the end of the novel, she has completely refused to accept relationships that are not on her own terms. Towards the end of the novel, we hear her talking about herself as one, as though she is, in some sense, beyond relationship. And again, it's a really chilling example of Pym gently saying, if you will not accept imperfection in relationships, reality in relationships, you will become a lonely, isolated fantasist. So there are all kinds of ways in which I think Pym gently, unobtrusively, offers us this Anglican tribe to observe, to see its strange ways, its strange mores, to see the real peculiarness of a lot of people who belong to it. She's perfectly clear about that. But also to see that it has values that are worth examining. Values that she nowhere says this is a value, but you see it in action, you see its effect on people, and you begin to see that she is gently recommending a way through the world. This acceptance this belonging to a bigger story, this sense of relationships that are about truth and kindness and forgiveness. Clearly, these are not just Anglican values, and again, Pim is perfectly clear about that. You don't have to be an Anglican to have these values. But on the other hand, the church is one of the places where you can still find them. And she finds that something to be celebrated and indeed recommended to us. So if it's a long time since you read any Barbara Pym, may I suggest you return fast. The ones that I have put on your handout, I suggest you do start with Some Tame Gazelle, which is the story of Belinda and Harriet Bede, in which there's one of the most... she's very good at terrible marriage proposals, and there's a terrible marriage proposal in this, in which a colonial bishop offers his hand to Belinda with no expectation whatsoever of being turned down, and is utterly, utterly taken aback when, in fact, he is turned down. There's another in which the poor Mr. Latimer, whom we saw earlier, makes a proposal to somebody whose name he can't even remember. And as he's proposing to her, saying, "Dear Janie, will you marry me?" She says, "My name's not Janie." And he thinks to himself, why is she interrupting with such minor points? So, again, a wonderful read. The classic ones, the pre-1977 ones, are all a much simpler kind of world. And it would be fascinating to think what kind of novels Barbara Pym would write now in the Anglican Church as it is. As I say, she had no illusions about it. She was perfectly clear that there were high church and low church. There were different tribes within this one tribe. It would be interesting to see what Pym made of ordained women in this world where it's very much women observing men in ministry. It would be interesting to see how she made that transition. We have wondered whether perhaps the latest equivalent is Catherine Fox. If any of you have read any of Catherine Fox's novels set in a cathedral close, they're much sharper than Pym. But again, with that real love of what she is excoriating. So I do recommend those. Quartet in Autumn, The Sweet Dove Died, and Unsuitable Attachment are much darker kind of books, but again, definitely worth a read. I personally am not convinced by the couple of her books which were published posthumously, which she did not herself choose to publish. She didn't edit them. She didn't offer them to publishers. So An Academic Question and Crampton Hodnett. You can see some of the same characters that emerge through different Pym stories, but very much unfinished Pym. And one of the interesting things that happens is that she tries to move outside the church setting in one or two, tries to move outside those two tribal worlds that she knows well of anthropologists and the Anglican parish church. And it's clear that she's not comfortable. She doesn't quite know how to do relationships outside those spheres. But nonetheless, she's always readable and always this gentle, humorous tone of voice. As you read her for sheer pleasure, read her for the lovely turn of phrase. But as you read her, see if you pick up what I'm suggesting about this world that she celebrates. That is a world that a lot of us perhaps take for granted or have or think is past. If it is past, what is to replace it? Where will there be places where strange people can come together, united around something that holds them together? Where will there be places where people can celebrate imperfection and reality and minister to each other with endless cups of tea? If not the Church of England, then where? And her world is very much to be celebrated in that respect. Thank you.
Jane, thank you very much for a fascinating tour. tour around Barbara Pym and some of her principal themes. Now, we do have some time for questions, or you may have some comments to make. We have a roving mic. I'm looking at Alice at the back here. And we're fine for a while. I know Jane's got a train to catch, but I'll make sure we stop in good time for that. Any questions or comments? Yes, at the back there.
I'm always fascinated by... Is it picking up? I'm always fascinated by the decision of Cape to stop publishing her and their justification that she wasn't really moving with the times, because reading those novels set in the 50s, I find them incredibly radical, primarily in their depiction of the female characters, their ambivalence towards marriage, and sometimes their ambivalence towards men, full stop, but also the depiction of homosexuality. And you mentioned the character of Piers. And I wondered whether you think that the parish setting perhaps almost does her a disservice, because it allows people to write her off as being quite cosy and safe, whereas actually some of the themes she's discussing are quite radical.
That's a very perceptive comment. She, I think maybe her publishers, when they decided to stop publishing her, were not really paying attention to what she was writing about. They saw the setting and thought, this is gentle and old-fashioned, and didn't see some of the really quite radical things that she was talking about. She, obviously, her publishers never told her why they decided to stop publishing her. They just said they didn't feel that they had the market for them anymore. So we're bound to be reading into it what were the reasons that they just decided too many female characters, too many middle-aged female characters. This odd kind of setting, either in an academic anthropology world or in an Anglican parish church. And if you think about the kind of things that were being published in the 60s, some of the complete blank, I can't remember her name, but Summer Birdcage. Who wrote Summer Birdcage? Margaret Drabble, thank you. And you can see why publishers think this is the kind of edgy young woman kind of novel that we do, that we can publish. But the response when she was starting to be republished suggests that her publishers may have been mistaken. It's extraordinary how huge the appetite is for Pym now all over the world. The number of academic articles about her is increasing year by year by year as people analyse this gently understated world. So it's fascinating to think, you know, were they just wrong at the time?
A very simple question, really. With that great gap when she wasn't being published, what was then published after? Was that written fresh, or I mean, what happened to the stuff that she didn't get published? Did she just stop writing, or is that what's come back in some of the things you're not so convinced about?
She never stopped writing, and it's quite poignant in her diaries. She writes about the fact that she is still writing novels, never knowing if they're ever going to be published or not. But as I said, she's a natural-born writer. She can't not write. Some of the things that were published posthumously were written in that period, but so were some of the things that appeared. She was able to publish really quite, as you can see, pretty well every year from 1977 onwards. So she had a lot in the bank there. She was 37 when she got her first novel published, if I've done my maths right. Again, in all that period, writing, hoping to be published, getting rejected. So she had drawers and drawers full of stuff. I think it may well be the mark of a true writer that you go on writing, whether you're being published or not. She just couldn't imagine how to process the world if she wasn't writing.
I just wonder if you could maybe, or if it's ever occurred to you, the difference between Barbara Pym's Anglicanism and if we consider Catholic female novelists like Flannery O'Connor or Muriel Spark, who I'd say their work is somehow more savage or somehow more violent. if that's ever been something you've... Oh, sorry. The work of Flannery O'Connor and Muriel Spark, whether their kind of Catholic voices compared to Pym's cosiness, if you will, as an Anglican writer, whether that's something you've thought about or could elucidate. If that's something you'd thought about or could elucidate. Sort of had the
thank you. Which is very interesting because cosy is one of Pym's favourite words. And yes, the contrast between Pym's world and Flannery O'Connor's world is quite striking. There's very little cruelty or savagery in Pym's world. And I would guess that that was true in her experience. She experienced some real unkindness on the part of lovers, for example, who clearly used and discarded her. But on the whole, she lives in a world where you hide a lot of that. And the sort of deep south Christian setting that Flannery O'Connor is talking about, which is full of grotesques and extraordinary cruelty, it would be fascinating to hear Barbara Pym writing Flannery O'Connor, wouldn't it? Or vice versa? Do you think, is that imaginable? And that may be, I wonder if it's part of the reason why she is such a popular writer. It's nice to go somewhere cosy from time to time. Cosy but not without interest and challenge.
I just wanted to add that I think part of her appeal is because she's subversive. The Anglo-Catholic world is very hierarchical. I mean, it's as hierarchical as you can get, isn't it, within the Christian tradition. And yet, if you look at how she treats the characters of, I don't know, Father Twissaday or whoever it may be, it's mocking. Mm. It may be a gentle mockery, but it's not reverential. Mm. It's not deferential. Mm.
No, she definitely does mock the world, the gentle mockery of the world of the church. And it is one of her strengths, I think, that she is very much a lay person. She never talks about the church hierarchy. You can tell from the way characters react, for example, to this colonial bishop, that they know he thinks he's important and needs to be treated as such. But he doesn't deeply impinge on the real daily work of the parish, which is gossip and tea and commenting on the vicar's sermon. And mostly the comments on the sermon are about its length rather than its content. So this the possibility of writing about the real hierarchy of the Church of England is just something she's not interested in, and there is a kind of mockery about that, but also the lay perspective on it, what actually matters. Most people don't go to church because of the hierarchy of the clergy. They go to church for the people that they meet in church, perhaps.
She wrote about gay relationships before they were legalised. Mm-hmm. And is it because the novel doesn't follow people into the bedroom that it was okay, or with Piers and Keith it doesn't become apparent till well on in the novel? Was that how it was accepted or for publication and by readers?
And that's, again, a really fascinating question. She doesn't go into the bedroom with any of her couples, and she doesn't in any way signal that she thinks these relationships that she's writing about are unusual. And I think it's the very gentleness and sort of ordinariness of them that probably gets them under the radar. Keith and Piers are sharing a house. And they clearly are a couple, but she doesn't make a big deal about that. They're just people who are making each other happy. And sex, in a very Anglican kind of way, is just not mentioned at all. It's interesting that most of her married couples are childless. I think Jane and Nicholas have a daughter who's a very successful character, actually. It's interesting to see him writing a quite a feisty younger woman character. But most of them don't have children, or if they do have children, they hardly appear. So the sense of it, of those relationships that are about partnership and friendship, probably did enable it to get under the radar. It's very interesting that nobody at the time seemed to pick up on these quite subversive relationships that she was depicting.
I just wondered whether Barbara Pym wrote about Jane Austen herself. Did she, you said, you know, people think of Jane Austen when they think of Barbara Pym. Did she herself write much about Jane Austen?
Did she compare herself with Jane Austen? Did she write about Jane Austen? Well, there's that little mention that I read at the end of No Fond Return of Love, where that the character Aylwin is comparing himself to somebody from Mansfield Park. She didn't she didn't write a lot about Austen, but she read English at Oxford. She was a very well-read person. If you look at, you can actually look at her library online and see all of the underlinings and things. She was incredibly well-read, and her books are full of little quotations, but not at all ostentatiously so. Some Tame Gazelle is obviously a quote from a poem, Something to Love, Oh, Something to Love. The reviewers that compared her with Jane Austen were on the whole being a bit patronising about her, in a way that is quite annoying, shall we say? Just sort of this choosing to paint on a very small palette, as though that in some sense undermines the craft there. So as far as I'm aware, she didn't write about Austen herself, but did read widely. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that she did write about Austen in her letters and diaries. She visited Jane Austen's house.
Thank you.
She touched her desk and said that she picked up some dust and hoped that it would rub off on her.
Thank you.
So Jane Austen was one of her absolute literary heroines.
Thank you.
So she was aware of a legacy there.
Wonderful. Thank you. That's a much better answer.
I was just wondering if you could say a little more about kind of the role of poetry for the characters in Pym. Quite often in their thought processes, they seem to relate their lives, their sort of tweedy, worthy lives, to something a little more romantic and colourful when they sort of put a few snippets of poetry in. And I wonder kind of what that's sort of about, really.
She is a great lover of poetry. And as I say, you could see the quotations all the way through. That's very interesting how her language gets more poetic and flowery. She's as with everything, she's able to use it quite humorously. So there's the great sermon that Archdeacon Hotcleave preaches when he's trying to out-preach a much more popular clergyman in the neighbouring parish who isn't learned at all, but for some reason everybody's going to his church rather than the archdeacon's, and to see how many quotations he can get in. So she's able to use it both mockingly and... but it is true that just as she... it is true that her characters tell themselves as though they're literary, if that makes sense. So just as she, when writing about herself, talks about herself in ways that make connections with literature and with poetry. So her characters also find poetry as well as the Anglican Church... giving them, making them part of a bigger structure, something that they don't have to invent for themselves. That's a very interesting question. I shall go away and think a bit more about that. We've obviously got some real Pym experts here, so please do feel free to chip in. I'm just a Pym reader. I'm not a Pym expert in that sense.
Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, you've majored a bit on the Anglican parish and all of that side, but you also talk about her inhabiting a world of anthropology. And you've talked about her using anthropological, her own expertise in how she writes. Just in terms of the culture of anthropologists, do you have any other connections there with the Church of England values? They have different values? Or is that just a non-question?
I thought it would be suitable to major on Anglicanism in this particular setting. And it's also happens to be a setting I know a little bit more about than anthropology. But I think that one of the things that they have in common that she sees in her books is that their interest in relationships. So anthropologists in her novels are often working on, you know, what are the marital family relationships in a tribe somewhere. And that kind of attention to the relationships that we see in the church setting as well, that's one of the things they have in common. I think, too, there is this sense of a shared set of practices and vocabulary for describing the world that those two different disciplines have. Make a reasonably self-contained group of people that you can write about with more enjoyment. So, yeah, thank you.
Jane, I'd very much like to thank you on behalf of all of us gathered here for a fascinating insight into Barbara Pym's works this evening, into her life, and into the sort of values that she both expressed and lived to as well. Speaking as an Anglican former archdeacon, I dutifully take note of what I said about sermons and so on. But thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure to hear from you this evening. Just before we thank Jane properly again, I ought to say that Jane's lecture, and indeed the two we've already heard on Dorothy L. Sayers and Rose Macaulay, and next week's lecture, which I'm going to give a little plug for, on P.D. James, are all going to feature in a book that's coming out next year. I think it's looking at Alison Bloomsbury. Yes, Bloomsbury will publish it. We haven't actually got a date, but it will be in 2018. Excellent women from Charlotte Bronte to P.D. James. And there's a stellar array of authors who are contributing to that book. So watch out for that when it comes. Next week, we're welcoming here Professor Alison Schell, who is going to speak on the works of P.D. James. Alison's here tonight, so looking forward to that, Alison. And can I just say that the reason why we're gathered here in Poets' Corner, which is not a place where we normally have lectures here in the Abbey, is for all the multitude of writers and musicians and other artists who are memorialised here and just around the corner, very few of them are women. And we thought it was rather appropriate then to hold this series of lectures here. We have got Jane Austen memorialised there, and we have got the Bronte sisters here, but that's almost it. So if you feel passionately, sorry? Peggy Ashcroft, but she's an actress. Yes. Margot Fontaine is under a chair somewhere here and so on. So there are some other, yeah, there are indeed. But if you feel passionately that we should do some more about women writers in Poets' Corner, let me make encouraging noises to you and write to the Dean. The Dean it is. Please do. He's inviting people to contribute. So, Jane, thank you very much indeed for all that you've given us tonight. I'm certainly going to go away and read properly some Barbara Pym for myself. And very glad to hear your encouragement to do so. Thank you very much indeed.